Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the distinguished and award-winning guitarist, Adam Levin. We talk about his highly acclaimed recordings and groundbreaking work in introducing new compositions, as well as his innovative work as a music educator. Before we begin, please hit like, follow, and subscribe, and any other button you happen to see down there. Also, leave a comment. I'm still trying to convince that stubborn algorithm that people are paying attention. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the show the distinguished and award-winning classical guitarist, Adam Levin. Hey, Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Of course. Thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's, for me, of course, this is kind of where I live. I mean, I'm a guitar guy too, so not nearly as good as you are, but I struggle along. And so it's, for me, it's fun to talk to other guitar players. And so I kind of want to get into this a little bit because I was listening to some of your music on Spotify recently, and I really like your repertoire. You're really a lot of modern stuff that we don't hear very often.
Yeah, so I think like many young classical guitarists, we had childhoods that were filled with Spanish music. So, you know, music of Rodrigo, Albéniz, Granados, Tafalla, Turina, sure. You name it. We're steeped in that tradition, the sound, the atmosphere that and the ambiance of that music. And I think it dawned on me that, you know, I was a white boy from the Midwest, and I couldn't have been further away from the Spanish sound and its essence. You know, I was just sort of, I was playing sort of a caricature of what I thought Spanish music should
sound. Oh, yeah, right.
So I think a lot of the new music that you hear on the 21st century Spanish guitar albums is a result of a curiosity of trying to answer for myself, what is the essence of the Spanish sound? Where does it come from? How do we sort of breathe life to this kind of music and be like a conduit between composer and audience? And so 21st century Spanish guitar was the answer for me and trying to get a little bit closer to the essence of that Spanish, that special Spanish sound that we all love so much.
I was surprised. I'm a self-taught guitar player, and so I kind of came in this through the back door, so to speak. And so my idea of Spanish music was late 19th century to most of the 20th century, that entire body. But there's so much more to it than that. When I started discovering, you know, Spanish Renaissance music and players like, yeah, Fernando Sor, Spanish, Aguado, you know. And I thought, boy, this isn't flamenco at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's vast. It goes across five centuries, and this the sort of like the Spanish DNA strands. What we know today as being the Spanish sound is really the amalgamation of so many cultures coming together. You know, the Jewish culture, the Muslim culture. North African culture, Spanish culture. It's a fusion of so many sounds coming together to create the Spanish sound, and it uses the people, the language, the, you know, with flamenco music, there's a lot of despair and sadness that comes through in that music. So gypsies are a nomadic people, and this sort of, I think there's a sadness around not being able to find a home. And I think that's infused in the music as well. And so it's so eclectic. And then I think Spanish music is in many ways, it's very cosmopolitan.
Yes.
Because it draws from so many different traditions.
Right. Yeah, I had, many, many, many years ago, I had a student who was from Spain, and he had never learned how to play guitar to his chagrin, and so I was showing him how to play, and of course, it's almost like a national sin there if you don't play.
Everybody plays it. grandparents, children, dogs, cats.
So anyway, but I was asking him about flamenco because I honestly don't know, and I like your word caricature of how we tended to approach it. But his description to me, which I thought was really kind of interesting, he said, picture a hot August night about 2 a.m., just, you know, and you've just left the bar, he said, and you're meeting with some friends in the alley. He said, that's flamenco.
That's about right. It's either from the bar or from the caves of Granada. It's one of those two places. It's truly a magical place. And I, Roger, I had the pleasure of residing in Spain for 3 years. I was fortunate to receive the Fulbright Scholarship in 2008 to investigate 20th and 21st century Spanish classical guitar music. And it was inspired actually by a girl.
A surprise.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember my girlfriend at the time, she called me while I was studying with the late and great Oscar Giglia, who was the torchbearer to Andre Segovia, an incredible pedagogue. Anyway, I was in Italy one summer studying with him, and my girlfriend at the time said, I'm going to Spain with you or without you. And I was like, no, you had to wait for me. So I applied for all the grants available, and I scored the Fulbright.
Wow, that's cool.
And it was an incredible, so I got the Fulbright, then I renewed it for a year, and then I got another grant for the third year. I mean, it was really a hat trick of fortune. And I think, again, it answered that question, what is the Spanish sound? I sort of was able to mask, I don't not mask, I mean, I think I more authentically can play Spanish music, having lived there, spoken the language, spoken to the composers. And what I also realized when I moved there is that Spanish music did not end with Joaquin Rodrigo. and that right there was a nugget of truth that led to the formation of those 21st century Spanish guitar albums, four volumes of four generations of classical composers from Spain from 1930 all the way to present day. And what I realized is that we're in a Spanish compositional renaissance. And wow. It was that moment where I was like, wow, I have the opportunity to work with all these composers and add to the repertoire in a really profound way. And it was the most enjoyable, one of the most, I would say, yeah, one of the most enjoyable like moments of my life, being able to work alongside these composers and bring these new pieces to life. I mean, it's also scary. Like when you bring a new piece into the repertoire, it's a great responsibility,
right?
Because it's never been performed before. So your responsibility is to communicate it in a compelling way so that not only the audience enjoys it, but hopefully future guitarists will want to play it as well. Because that will then become the new canon.
It's astonishing music. I was listening to some of it, I think volume two, it's kind of jaw dropping in its scope. You play extremely well. Let me just toss that out there, as one would expect. But the music is wonderful. I've said this before on the show that my cookie at the end of the day is I will sit down and before I go to bed, and I'll watch YouTube and pick up different videos and so on and so forth. And everybody's playing the same handful of pieces. I performed Leyenda for years. I performed Recuerdos for years. I don't touch them anymore. I have nothing to say. It's like, you know, I want to see something new, you know, at least new to me. So the idea that you're bringing some new stuff to the table is wonderful.
I love the standard repertoire that we have. Those pieces you mentioned, Leyenda, Recuerdos, they're unbelievable pieces. That's why people keep playing.
Right. But and the audience loves them.
And the audience loves them. But I think it is our responsibility as performers, as artists, as creators, to contribute to the progress of the instrument. And part of the progress of the instrument is producing new repertoire, and not just arrangements, but new commissions, just as Andres Segovia, as Julian Bream, Elliot Fisk, Sharon Isbin, as a whole long line of people have done in the past. And that is what will crystallize the classical guitar of today and tomorrow, is really pushing the aural limits of humanity. And sometimes, and that's what I love about, you know, the Spanish Music Project is not every piece is for everybody. Some people are like, oh, that's disgusting. The next one they might be like, wow, that's incredible. And it only takes one piece, one listen, to change somebody's view on contemporary music, because I feel like it gets a bad rap. You know, like people think about contemporary music, they're like, oh my God, it's gonna be so dissonant, or it's gonna be not accessible. But I'm sorry to say that new music means so much. It's a vast array of sounds, techniques, visions for contemporary music. So I think part of it is breaking down the barrier to new music, and also just empowering young people, or really just anybody, to take the leap forward to listen to contemporary music. If you're a musician, to play contemporary music. And if you be so bold to find a composer, a friend that writes, and ask them to write something for you.
It's how are your audiences responding to this? I mean, it's difficult to find an audience when you're playing the very accessible stuff. At least it seems to me.
For me, I think it's a balanced approach. And I always like to use the sort of bait and switch trick. So you give them a little bit of what they want, and then you include something that they didn't know they wanted. And most of the time, you get a really positive response. And honestly, even when I don't get a positive response, you get a reaction. And a reaction is what music is all about. Yeah, it doesn't. It's about the good, bad, and ugly. And that's music is supposed to bring out all the emotions, the whole palette of emotions. So I think it's a net win-win, regardless of like, oh, you know, I like this piece or not. It's pushing the audience into the future, into today.
I think I had as a guest on here about a year ago, the wonderful composer Victoria Bond, and she does a new music festival in New York City every year as well with different artists, and we were talking about teaching the audience how to listen to it. You know, that seems to be a challenge. It's a challenge. I don't know, it's not insurmountable, but it's just teaching people that you don't listen to this the same way that you listen to pop music, that it's a different approach.
I think that's really wonderful to bring up is the education of our audiences. Like, so many times there's like this barrier from the stage to the audience. So even like little prompts, verbal prompts,
right,
go a long way to inviting people into the music you're about to play. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be long, but just giving them something to grab onto, to listen to, and breaking it down in a vernacular that they'll understand can be very helpful. And I think that conversation is really important. I think it also brings the piece to life in a new way, and also brings the personality of the musician out a little bit more. And I think that's really the conversation.
Very important.
Is
very important. I did a series of programs for elementary schools many years ago. And just playing, introducing classical guitar and the guitar in general, And I would play the music, and for the most part, I refused to dumb it down. Didn't matter that they were in the second grade, and so. But I remember playing the famous Bouderie by Bach from the First Lute Suite, and for me, that was my introduction to classical guitar. That was the first piece that I thought, if I don't do anything else, I want to learn that one.
Jimmy Page played that one.
I'm sorry?
Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin played the Beret as well.
Yeah. Paul McCartney used it as an inspiration to write Blackbird, and
I did not know that.
Yeah, he. Well, anyway, I would tell these little children, you know, first, second, third graders, I'd tell them, you know, it was written a long time ago, and of course, everything to them was a long time ago. Anyway, but then I would say, the fun part about this is if you listen closely, it sounds like two people playing at the same time. Because it's just perfect two voice counterpoint. I mean, it's absolutely pristine. And then I would play it. And of course, it's a short piece, a couple of minutes long. And they would sit there. Imagine a gymnasium full of these little children. And it's dead quiet. All you can hear is the guitar. And the teachers, their jaws are dropped like this. Because they've never seen those children that quiet ever, particularly in a room full of them. But all I had to do was tell them how to listen, and listen they did, and they loved it. They absolutely loved it.
I'm glad you bring up young people, because I think, you know, as we segue from new music and sort of pushing our audiences into the 21st century, it's also important to educate our young people, our youngest people, about classical music.
Yes.
About music in general, and that, you know, we always talk about, oh, will this orchestra exist in 10 years, or what's happening to our audiences, are they going to disappear? Well, the answer to both of those is creating a young generation that is sensitive to classical music across the ages. And so I, you know, in addition to being a performing artist, touring, going around the world, you know, playing solo and chamber music, you know, with violin or mandolin or my guitar trio or cello, I'm fiercely dedicated to sharing the fortunes that I probably, when I was young, probably took for granted, that were just around me. Classical, you know, guitar lessons. Let's go to your guitar lesson every week. Here's a classical guitar for you to play on. That's a wonderful concert instrument. It wasn't until much later that I realized that's not normal, that not everybody's as fortunate to have that.
Right.
And all of the sort of transformative qualities that I was the recipient of should be accessible by all. So I wanted, and this was in part the vision of Elliot Fisk, who was my teacher, and to go out and be an ambassador for your instrument. And part of that is giving back and creating a community, young people who are playing the classical guitar, and through that becoming more sensitive human beings. And so that in college, in graduate school, I did many performance outreach events. I don't really like that word outreach, but I partnered with many organizations to share the classical guitar in non-traditional venues with underserved and at-risk children and youth. And that sort of came together in the formation of Kithara Project. And Kithara Project is a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to improving the lives of young people and children and youth through the classical guitar. So that's basically, in nuts and bolts, putting classical guitars in the hands of these young people at no cost, and providing them with group and individual instruction, and year after year giving them the education that they deserve, a first class comprehensive classical guitar education with all the accoutrements. And that started in Boston and Mexico City, and has expanded to Detroit, Albuquerque, and now our newest program, which is launching in September in Providence, Rhode Island, same state where I'm on faculty at the University of Rhode Island. So it's been for the last 10 years, we're actually celebrating our 10th anniversary.
Well, but congratulations.
Thank you so much, Roger. Yeah, it's been a journey. I never in a million years thought I'd be running a nonprofit organization. You know, I thought it would only be, you know, teaching young people at a collegiate level and touring. But I had this sort of undeniable sort of impulse to share the classical guitar with those who are perhaps less fortunate. And Cathar Project was that answer, and it's been really incredible. And the group and individual instruction, concert attendance opportunities, performance opportunities, jury exams like my university students receive, so they reach their benchmarks. It's creating a accessible classical guitar ecosystem where, you know, anybody who wants to play can join Cathar Project and thrive.
Pretty much based my career. When I was in my 20s, I wanted to be a performer, but I got away from that as I got married and had children. The idea of touring just really didn't. As a matter of fact, I turned down a recording contract when I was 28, and because I didn't want to go on the road and I didn't want to have to support the album. And so that said, I started teaching at a music store. When you say that, people tend to think of these mom and pop places and a converted converted closet with a cloth over the door for privacy. This really wasn't. We had this was a real music school. We had about 45 faculty. Probably half of them had advanced degrees, and were touring performers in their own right. And it's a long story. I won't go into it. But this was in Lansing, East Lansing, Michigan. And so I had people bringing their young children to me, 5 and 6 years old. And so I had to teach myself how to teach them. And I had to create materials because at that time, nothing existed. Well, I can't say nothing. There were a couple of methods out there, but they were really written for like 10 or 12 year old kids. They just had cooler cartoons. That's all they were. And so I had to create age specific things and trial by error and such. And the other thing that I had decided was, A, I'm a classical guitarist, but B, if you go to a piano studio, you are going to learn how to play classical piano. They don't say classical piano. It's just piano, right? You're going to play Beethoven. End of conversation. You're going to play Bach. End of conversation. And I thought, why should guitar be any different? Why do I have to teach chords and blues and country licks and things like that, you know, and particularly at 5 years old? When they're 5 and 6 years old, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb is a big deal. Hot Cross Buns is pretty exciting. and so why not tap into that? I run into these students now periodically who are now adults. I actually had 3 students come to me whose parents studied with me when they were little. And they brought them to me because they understand the value of learning how to play the guitar. And I just thought, for a lot of these kids, this is the only musical education they're going to get. So it ought to be a good one.
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be a transformational experience. And regardless of whether they go into music or not, it'll give them the tool bag of skills to conquer the world.
Well, plus they will learn to appreciate art in its various forms rather than just have it imposed upon them through you know, social media, what have you. They can seek out the better stuff, you know. And hey, you know, it's like food. I like a hot dog as much as the next guy, but there are times when I really want to sink my teeth into some beef Wellington too. You know?
When you mention hot dog, I mean, I'm a Chicago boy, so I mean, hot dog is part of my DNA. That
preaching to the choir. That's funny. Well, you're touring. How many concerts do you do in a given year?
I would say somewhere between 45 and 60.
Man, that's a busy
yeah.
schedule.
Yeah, I would. It's a busy schedule. You know, and my life as a musician is a collage of many sections.
Oh yeah.
And what, you know, one is a performing artist, one is a recording artist, one is one as a university professor at the University of Rhode Island. You know, what one is a music activist, you know, supporting and promoting Kithara Project and the wonderful work that we're trying to do. And also the job of being a family man. You know, I'm a father, I'm a husband, and that takes a lot of work as well. Mm-hmm. And so it sometimes feel like I am pushing Noah's Ark. and it's, you know what, I love that feeling. I mean, even before pushing Noah's Ark, there's sort of like this undying flame inside of me that just this ferociously wants all of it, that right. loves the classical guitar and everything that comes with it. And I think that's the potential energy that I need in order to do it all. And you know, it's a lot. You know, I even run an annual guitar and mandolin festival at my university, the University of Rhode Island Guitar and Mandolin Festival, which comes up every October. This year is our 10th anniversary.
Wow.
8 days of crazy music making, an amazing classical guitar education. We have a composer in residence. We have an international guitar and mandolin competition at the young artist and high school levels. We have a Rising Stars program for young people. We have an adult program, and we have it all. I mean, it's a comprehensive festival, and we've got incredible artists too from all around the world.
And wow, that's cool.
So, a lot of stuff going. There's never a dull moment in the Levin Hemisphere.
So you also do quite a bit of chamber music. Now, is your chamber repertoire mirror your solo repertoire, or is that kind of a different departure?
It mirrors it insofar as we do a lot of new music. Like, for example, my longest standing chamber partnership is with William Knuth, who is the head of strings at Syracuse University. And we've been playing together since graduate school. We met on a lark. I mean, we were placed together after, I think we both signed up for chamber music too late, and we were one another's only choice. And you know, Will could have ended up with a string quartet or what have you, and I probably could have just ended up with another guitarist or whatever. And we ended up together, and we had a great musical chemistry. And 20 years later, we're still playing together and playing everything from Szymanowski arrangements, Foss arrangements. Actually, both of those arrangements were done by Greg Nestor, who you just interviewed.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
A fantastic arranger, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
Best on the planet. So that's been a strong partnership. I also have been working with my trio, the Grey Necks, on Crazy Arrangements by Sibelius. The Planets, Bach orchestral suites, just really nutso arrangements. So that's stuff we're doing. And then I work with the cellist Michael Shane, and we've been doing Schumann, Vivaldi, Defaya. There's a wonderful young female Spanish composer, Casarubios, who we have been playing a work by, Silvestrov, the Ukrainian composer. And then the other main chamber music partnership is Duo Mantar with my mandolinist, Jacob Reuven from Israel. And we've been touring here, there, everywhere for 7 years. And it's been a wonderful partnership that actually started because my father sent me a YouTube link of him playing a piece that I had transcribed for guitar that he had transcribed for mandolin. and I wrote him, I was like, hey, you know, Jacob, great job. I just wanted to commend you on the wonderful performance. He's like, you won't believe the, is like, he said, thank you for writing me first. And then he said, you won't believe the timing, but I just received a grant to record an album of modern Israeli music. And I was like, and I need, it's for mandolin and guitar. And I don't know a guitarist. And so I was like, I'll be that guitarist. So I traveled to Spain where he and his wife live, and we played about 10 minutes of music and then went to those Spanish bars that you were talking about earlier and partied a little bit and found out that, you know, we really got along. And ever since then, we've been touring. That's been seven or eight years now.
I was going to say, I am such a fan of guitar and chamber music, and I've played with cellists, and I was in a chamber group with a flute and clarinet at one point, and that was that was a cool sound. And
I love the clarinet. For me, the clarinet is such a warm and toasty instrument.
Well, sitting between the two of them, and you get all these swirling harmonics that I had never experienced before, because I'm not a band guy, you know. It's just all, and I'm going, wow, that very distracting, you know. It's almost like a third and a fourth person in there, or fourth and fifth person. It was that I've done that. I worked with another flutist. We did stuff for 25 years, guitar, flute stuff, and I just. As much as I love multiple guitars, I love the idea of and the sound of a guitar with other instruments. I've worked with a oboist, a couple of different oboists, and different. It's just, I love the combinations.
It's amazing to play chamber music because it's a true partnership. There's, you know, being a soloist is great. I love getting up on stage and just being alone with the audience.
Right.
But on the contrary, it can be kind of lonely too. And so it's nice to breathe life into music with somebody else.
It's also a nice safety net, you know, because you know if something goes, if you're up there by yourself and you screw up, you know how to cover it up and keep moving. When you're with somebody else, they know how to cover you up.
God forbid something should happen. No, absolutely. You know, I've loved doing chamber music from day one, and it also allows you to play music by composers that you never would have played. Szymanowski, Foss, they didn't write guitar. Right. Actually, Foss did write a guitar concerto.
He wrote for Sharon Isman.
Yeah, and just incredible. And it's also our bridge to new audiences.
Yes.
Like people love the violin. They love the mandolin, you know, through bluegrass. They love the cello. I mean, it's one of the most traditional classical instruments. So it's our portal to another world and to getting away from the guitar ghetto, which is potent.
Well, we do live in a bubble if we're not careful.
Yes.
And so it's a bit of a problem. So, Adam, believe it or not, we just ran out of string. We're all out of time, my friend.
Oh, man. I was just getting started. Roger, this was so much fun.
Me too. We'll have to do it again soon. I'd like
that. Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit about my musical life.
I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks, Adam. Appreciate it. See you now. I'd like to thank Adam Levin for coming on the show and sharing his insights with us. I'd like to thank you, too, for spending your time with us. Please invite your friends to join us here at Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.